Isaiah, chapters 33, 34, and 35, the 23rd talk in a series on Isaiah, was presented by David Crabtree on August 11, 2013, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2013. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We'll be looking at chapter 33, 34, and 35 in Isaiah. We are just about at a change in the text of Isaiah. Up to now, it's been prophetic, it's been poetic, and it's been describing this advance of the Assyrians, and we've kind of watched that over, it's a number of years that the account in Isaiah is responding to. But it's going to change in chapter 36 to historical narrative, and it'll be historical narrative for four chapters. So this is the last part of the prophetic statements that he makes until the historical narrative hits. And then at chapter 40, it will continue prophetic, but there's a marked change in the text, and we'll see that when we get to it. So let me bring you up to date. I want to make sure that you're aware of the historical background to this section. I've talked about some of this before, so I'll just go over some of it very briefly. But if you'll recall, when we first started the book of Isaiah, the king was Ahaz, and Isaiah's word to him was, don't join an alliance with the two countries that were trying to get Judah to join their alliance was the northern kingdom of Israel and Syria or Aram. Those two countries were trying to get Judah to join them in alliance against Assyria. And they were fearful at the time that Assyria would be on its way. Isaiah said, don't join that alliance. Ahaz did not join that alliance. But what he did do is he made friends with Assyria. He called Assyria in to defend Judah against the northern kingdom and Syria. And in so doing, he obligated himself to pay a certain amount of tribute on an annual basis to Assyria. He also obligated Judah to worship the gods of Assyria, which King Ahaz did. And he imposed that on his people with some success. In 715, so this is 10 to 15 years later, Ahaz's son becomes the king, Hezekiah. And Hezekiah wants to change things in Judah. He wants to change things politically, and he wants to change things religiously. He doesn't want to pay tribute to Assyria anymore, and he's got patriotic types who are supporting him in that direction. And he doesn't want to worship the gods of Assyria anymore, and he has religious types that are pushing him in that direction. So apparently he makes a change slowly, but he begins to implement some changes within the kingdom to move in the direction of becoming independent from Syria, both religiously and politically. There were other countries in the Levant, other kingdoms, that were also having to pay tribute to Assyria on a regular basis. And they're looking out at the world scene, and they see Assyria at a time of weakness now. By the time we get to 715, 714, 713, we're seeing indications of weakness in Assyria, primarily because Assyria is under attack from every direction, and they had a change in kings, and everybody is taking advantage of that, and they want to rid themselves of having to pay tribute to Assyria. So there are several countries in the Levant, so in what is now Lebanon and then Palestine, who decide to take this opportunity to stop paying tribute to Assyria. Apparently, Judah does not join in this at this particular time in 712. So in 712, Assyria decides that they are not going to allow that to happen in Palestine. They are going to force those kingdoms to pay tribute. So they make an expedition to Palestine to collect the money that is due them. They march through, and their primary targets are some Philistine cities on the coast. And those Philistine cities are thinking that they can just appeal to Egypt, and Egypt will come to their defense. And this is a period of time when Egypt is beginning to gain strength again. Assyria comes in. They destroy the Philistine cities. The leaders of those Philistine cities flee to Egypt. Assyria goes down to the border of Egypt and says, turn them over to us or else we're coming in. And Egypt says, here they are. So Egypt didn't turn out to be all that helpful in that contest. But after that, by 710, Egypt is stronger than it had been in 712. It is reunited. Egypt has historically had this problem between it wanting to separate the northern part and the southern part, the more delta part and then the uplands. They tend to want to separate, and on a number of occasions that separation occurred. Well, that separation had been in place for a number of years, but now it's all unified in 710, and Egypt is a stronger nation at this point. So Hezekiah is now speeding up his reforms, and as I mentioned before, making changes, building walls, changing their water system, so that they can withstand a siege much better. And they apparently stop at this point worshiping the gods of Assyria, and someplace during this period stop paying tribute to Assyria. Interestingly, it would appear that Hezekiah was trying to unite the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. They had been divided since the time after Solomon died. So they've been divided for about a century or more than a century. And it would appear that Hezekiah was trying to bring them back together. The northern kingdom had been conquered by Assyria. Other peoples had been moved in to live with the Israelites in the northern kingdom. So in that area, the people, the populace, which is a combination of these foreigners and Israelites, are worshiping all kinds of gods. And Hezekiah's appeal is to those who are in the northern kingdom, come and join us, and you can worship in Jerusalem at the temple. And that apparently had some impact, and there were a number of people from the northern kingdom who moved down during this period of time and became a part of Judah. And it's apparently at this time that the Assyrians become worried about this. They don't want them to be united. And so the Assyrians decide to counter what Hezekiah is doing by bringing in some priests, people who had been priests in the northern kingdom. They bring them and had been taken away into moved to other parts of the Assyrian Empire to colonize those areas, brought them back to Israel to teach the Israelites how to worship Yahweh, but to worship Yahweh the way it had been done in the northern kingdom, that is, to worship him at Mount Gerizim rather than in Jerusalem. So apparently it was an attempt to keep the two kingdoms separate. Assyria didn't want them to be united. In 704, Sennacherib becomes the king of Assyria, and Judah is in full out rebellion against Assyria. They are no longer paying tribute, and in fact, they are trying to encourage other kingdoms in the area to join in their resistance to Assyria, Philistine cities as well as some Phoenician cities. And they had been encouraged to do this, to go in full-scale rebellion, by the Babylonians, who are also wanting to go in full-scale rebellion, and they're trying to time these to happen at the same time so that Assyria is divided. They have a multi-front conflict that they're going to have to deal with. Okay, in 701 then, the Assyrians come. They want to put down these rebellions and restore their control over the entire area. And in 701, it's Palestine that they want to control, restore to their order. They come out and they go into Lebanon, to the coastline. One of the first cities that they attack is Tyre. And they very quickly bring Tyre to its knees. And once that happens, everybody knows that it's just a matter of time till they march down the coast and take all of the cities back that they had had control of in the past. So Judah's allies begin to start peeling off, and Judah is stuck alone. So Hezekiah decides there's no hope. We are going to send emissaries out to the Assyrians with a whole bunch of tribute. We'll pay them off and ask them to leave quietly. And maybe we can keep things intact. So these emissaries go out, talk to the Assyrians, pay them a whole bunch of tribute, come to an agreement. Then those emissaries come back to Jerusalem, and Assyria acts like no agreement had been reached whatsoever. They're going to keep the tribute, and they're just going to continue on and destroy Judah. So those are the circumstances under which these next chapters were apparently written, and some of that shows up in the text that we will see. Chapter 33, then, the first six verses. Woe to you, O destroyer, while you were not destroyed, and he who is treacherous, while others did not deal treacherously with him. As soon as you shall finish destroying, you shall be destroyed. As soon as you shall cease to deal treacherously, others shall deal treacherously with you. O Lord, be gracious to us. We have waited for thee. Be thou their strength every morning, our salvation also in the time of distress. At the sound of the tumult, peoples flee. At the lifting up of thyself, nations disperse. And your spoil is gathered as the caterpillar gathers, as locusts rushing about, men rush about on it. The Lord is exalted, for he dwells on high. He has filled Zion with justice and righteousness. And he shall be the stability of your times, a wealth of salvation, wisdom, and knowledge. The fear of the Lord is his treasure. It begins with a woe to the destroyer and to the treacherous. We've seen similar words that he used earlier in chapter 24 when he was talking about the time to come when Israel would be glorious. But if you'll recall, he kind of stops having described that. He kind of stops and he reflects on everything that's going to happen before them. And it looks ominous. And that's where he says, the treacherous will deal treacherously. Let's see, it's 24:16. From the ends of the earth we hear songs, glory to the righteous one. But I say, woe to me, alas for me. The treacherous deal treacherously, and the treacherous deal very treacherously. So this is where it looks, the future of Israel is truly glorious, truly magnificent. And he's described that, but then he stops and says, woe to me, for the treacherous deal treacherously. There's going to be a whole bunch of bad stuff. There's going to be a whole bunch of activity by treacherous people and treacherous countries that happen before the glorious destiny of Israel is reached. So now he's using similar language, but he's saying to the destroyer and to the treacherous, while you're destroying and while you're treacherous, it may not go poorly for you. But as soon as you stop being a destroyer, as soon as you stop being treacherous, it's going to turn on you. And you will be the one that's dealt with treacherously and that is destroyed. So it's a sudden turn that's going to happen to those that are destroying and treacherous. Clearly, what he has foremost in mind in this particular point is Assyria. Assyria's fortunes will change very dramatically. Then he talks about God's graciousness towards his people. We have waited for thee. So it's God's people waiting patiently for God to act, and God will ultimately be gracious towards his people. It's to him that they've looked to for their strength and their salvation, and that will graciously come about. Verses 3 and 4 are describing how people will respond when God finally acts. At the sound of the tumult, peoples flee. At the lifting up of thyself, nations disperse. All God has to do is just start to act, speak, and the enemies, his enemies, the enemies of Judah are sent fleeing. Verse 4 is a little bit difficult. I don't quite get the image, but the concept I think is clear, and that is that God, in causing the enemies, his enemies to flee, they are going to leave spoil. They are going to leave plunder, plunder that they have gathered as plunder. All that will be left behind for God and his people. So, and your spoil is gathered as the caterpillar gathers. And I'm not sure how a caterpillar gathers spoil. As locusts rushing about, men rush about on it. And I guess that means it's just swarming with people who are carrying that plunder away. And I assume that's God's people that are doing it. The Lord is exalted, for he dwells on high. He has filled Zion with justice and righteousness. I think that the idea behind this couplet is an interesting one, and that is, God is exalted, for he dwells on high. That God is transcendent. God dwells on high. There's a sense in which God is elsewhere. It's not that he's not present here, but he's above all of this. He's transcendent on the one hand, but on the other hand, he has filled Zion with justice and righteousness. He has condescended, in the good sense of the term condescended. He has reached down and filled Zion with justice and righteousness. In verse 6, he shall be the stability of your times, a wealth of salvation, wisdom, and knowledge. The fear of the Lord is his treasure. So God is the source of, and an abundant source of salvation, wisdom, and knowledge. And fear of the Lord is a true treasure. So these are words of encouragement that Isaiah is speaking primarily to the people of Judah. Next section. Behold, their brave men cry in the streets. The ambassadors of peace weep bitterly. The highways are desolate. The traveler has ceased. He has broken the covenant. He has despised the cities. And some of your translations probably have witnesses. Witnesses is going to be a better translation there. He has no regard for man. The land mourns and pines away. Lebanon is shamed and withers. Sharon is like a desert plain, and Bashan and Carmel lose their foliage. Now this is apparently talking about what's happening in Jerusalem. Behold, their brave men cry in the streets, and the there is the people of Judah. Their brave men cry in the streets, and the ambassadors of peace weep bitterly. This is apparently their response to the fact that Assyria, having received the tribute and having agreed not to come and destroy Jerusalem, are now breaking that word and continuing on their way. And so the people of Judah, the brave men of Judah, cry in the streets, and the ambassadors of peace weep bitterly. So that's the condition. Furthermore, the highways are desolate. The traveler has ceased. Why? Because Assyria is marching through the land. There are no more travelers. It's too dangerous to travel. He has broken the covenant. He has despised the witnesses. So this is apparently referring to the king of Assyria. He has broken the covenant. That is, he has gone back on the agreement that he has made. He has despised the cities. I have cities and witnesses. Those two words look almost identical. The only difference is a tittle on one of the letters, and which means that a resh is rounded at the corner and a dalet is square at the corner and has just a little tag off to the side. If that tag is not there, it looks just like a resh. And it's just a little tiny tag. And with my eyesight, it's difficult to tell the difference. It makes more sense that he has despised the witnesses, because it couples with he has broken the covenant. So that's more likely what the original reading would have been. So he has broken the covenants, and he has despised the people who witnessed the making of those covenants. He doesn't care that there are witnesses there. He's going to go back on his word anyway. He has no regard for man. He doesn't care about the rules of propriety, the rules of goodness in the way that people deal one with another. Okay, so there are people crying in the streets, the highways are desolate, and the land mourns and pines away. And then it lists four of the most productive areas of Israel. Lebanon is shamed and withers. Sharon is like a desert plain. Bashan and Carmel lose their foliage. So those four areas are some of the most productive areas of Israel, and they are devastated. And they've been devastated in all likelihood by the Assyrian army. Armies back in those days didn't carry food with them. They would get food as they marched along. So any place an army went was always devastated, especially if it's a large army. So the land mourns and pines. He's using the land and its condition to be a picture, symbolic of the destruction that has come to Israel and Judah. And we'll come back to that later in the passage. Next section. Now I will arise, says the Lord. Now I will be exalted. Now I will be lifted up. You have conceived chaff. You will give birth to stubble. My breath will consume you like a fire, and the peoples will be burned to lime, like cut thorns which are burned in the fire. So now God says, I'm going to take action. I'm going to rise. And I will be exalted. I will be lifted up. That is to say, he will show himself and his both his strength and his faithfulness to his people. He will show himself and will be worthy of that exaltation. You, that is the Assyrians, you have conceived chaff. You will give birth to stubble. He's used that image before, giving birth to wind, giving birth to nothing. And the idea is a lot of work that doesn't accomplish anything. Assyria has done a lot of work, but they will accomplish nothing because his breath is going to consume them like a fire. In verse 12, it says, and the peoples will be burned to lime. Why does he say peoples? If he's just talking about Assyria, why doesn't he say, and your people, or something like that? As I've talked about before, I think we have a phenomenon here that we've seen elsewhere, and that is, he's talking about Assyria in a sense. Assyria is the manifestation of the rebelliousness against God that we see in mankind. Assyria is coming to attack God's people in Judah. So Assyria is representative of those who would resist, fight against God and his purposes. So when it says, and the peoples will be burned to lime, peoples, and we've seen before, he uses the term peoples and nations to stand for those groups of people who fight against God's purposes. So I think he's talking in much more ultimate terms than just talking about Assyria. Assyria is the current manifestation of a phenomenon that is a much broader phenomenon, and God is going to deal with the Assyrians, but what Isaiah's really, his primary topic is, he's going to deal with all of those who are rebellious against God's purposes. We've seen that kind of phenomenon before in Isaiah. I think it's very prevalent. Like cut thorns which are burned in the fire, they're going to be burned and reduced to ashes. And we've seen this image of burning used a number of times to stand for the judgment that will come. Next section. You who are far away, hear what I have done, and you who are near, acknowledge my might. Sinners in Zion are terrified. Trembling has seized the godless. Who among us can live with the consuming fire? Who among us can live with continual burning? He who walks righteously and speaks with sincerity, he who rejects unjust gain and shakes his hands so that they hold no bribe, he who stops his ears from hearing about bloodshed and shuts his eyes from looking upon evil, he will dwell on the heights. His refuge will be the impregnable rock. His bread will be given him. His water will be sure. So now he turns and talks about the fates that are coming, the fate for the sinners and the fate for the righteous that lie in store for them. He starts out by saying, you who are far away, hear what I have done, and you who are near, acknowledge my might. In other words, everyone, near and far, take note of what I have done. Now, the two fates with respect to the sinners, and in particular, this is sinners in Zion. The sinners in Zion are terrified. Trembling has seized the godless. Who among us can live with the consuming fire? Who among us can live with continual burning? Okay. What he's talking about, apparently, is sinners in Zion find it unlivable, unbearable. That is, the unjust living with the holy, being in the presence of the holy, cannot last. They will be consumed in a fire. And it is a continual fire. And again, I think he's talking about the final judgment to come, a continual burning. Now he turns to the righteous and he says, all who do these things will have the fate listed in verse 16. And what are those things? It's to walk righteously, to speak with sincerity, to reject unjust gain, to take no bribes, to not listen to or listen to anything about bloodshed, and to not look on evil. Interestingly, the things that are listed here all refer to parts of the body. So it's walking, so your feet are involved. Speak with sincerity, so the mouth is involved. I don't know what part of the body he who rejects unjust gain, but I suspect there's a part of the body that's being referred to there. Maybe it's the heart, I'm not sure. But then shakes his hands so that they take no bribes, stops his ears so he doesn't hear bloodshed, and shuts his eyes from looking upon evil. So I think what's being described here is a whole person that is devoted to righteousness. Every part of this person. That person will dwell on the heights. His refuge will be the impregnable rock. We've seen the rock used many, many times in Isaiah. The place of stability, security, the place that can't get washed away by the flood. His bread will be given him, his water will be sure. So he'll be provided for. There will be both bread and water that is there in abundance for him. Interesting that if this is indeed on the eve of the siege, that would be a nice thing to know, that one is going to be receive bread and water. Okay, we'll do the rest of the chapter in the next section. Your eyes will see the king in his beauty. They will behold a far distant land. Your heart will meditate on terror. Where is he who counts? Where is he who weighs? Where is he who counts the towers? You will no longer see a fierce people, a people of unintelligible speech, which no one comprehends, of a stammering tongue, which no one understands. Look upon Zion, the city of our appointed feasts. Your eyes shall see Jerusalem, an undisturbed habitation, a tent which shall not be folded, its stakes shall never be pulled up, nor any of its cords be torn apart. But there the majestic one, the Lord, shall be for us a place of rivers and wide canals, on which no boat with oars shall go, and on which no mighty ship shall pass. For the Lord is our judge, the Lord is our lawgiver, the Lord is our king, he will save us. Your tackle hangs slack, it cannot hold the base of its mast firmly nor spread out the sail. Then the prey of an abundant spoil will be divided, the lame will take the plunder, and no resident will say, I am sick. The people who dwell there will be forgiven their iniquity. So he's describing now a future that awaits Israel. And they're going to see a king in his beauty. They're out of the distance, there's this king that they will see in his beauty. And when they see this king, their heart is going to wonder why they were ever terrorized, why they ever felt their anxiety, their concerns. And they're going to wonder, where is the one who counts? And I assume that means tribute. So this is in reference to the king of Assyria, primarily. Where is he who counts the money? Where is the one who weighs the money? Where is he who counts the towers? And apparently they had to pay tribute according to the number of towers they had on their walls. So it's in proportion to their defensive capabilities, they had to pay tribute. And they're going to wonder, why were we terrorized? Where is that person who oppressed us? And in verse 19, you'll no longer see a fierce people, a people of unintelligible speech who no one comprehends, stammering tongue. They're going to be gone. Those foreigners, they're going to be gone. You will instead look upon Zion, the city of our appointed feasts. And when they see Jerusalem, they'll see an undisturbed habitation. And then it describes it as a tent. Interestingly, the people of Israel historically have seen themselves as a migrant nation, a nation that had to move. And that's largely coming from the Exodus. And so now Isaiah is using an image where he's basically making the tent that was their home when they were moving, the tent is going to be permanent. The tent is going to be fixed. A tent which shall not be folded, its stakes shall never be pulled up, nor any of its cords be torn apart. So here's a tent that's permanent. It's no longer a mobile abode. So an undisturbed habitation that is, they won't have to move from again. And Jerusalem will be well defended. God, the majestic one, the Lord, shall be for us. And then I think the rivers, the wide canals on which no boat with oars shall go and no mighty ship shall pass. I think the idea is this will be well protected and secure. And no boats, no ships can come against them. Because God is their judge, their lawgiver, their king, and their savior. And he will protect them. Now this last image is a little difficult. Your tackle hangs slack. It cannot hold the base of its mast firmly nor spread out the sail. So it's like he's saying, on your ship, the ropes, the tackle, is slack. It's not doing any good. And the tackle served two purposes. One was to hold the mast in place, and the other was to hold the sails in place. And there, on their ship, the tackle can't do either one. So it appears to be describing a ship that is just barely making it to port. It really can't control where it goes anymore. It's in bad shape. So it's barely making it into port. It can't really go anywhere. But the prey of an abundant spoil will be divided. The lame will take the plunder. There's going to be an abundance of food and wealth there for them to enjoy, even though they have limped into port. I think that's the image. And no resident will say, I am sick, and the people who dwell there will be forgiven their iniquity. So there will be forgiveness, and there will be health in this Jerusalem that's coming. Okay, next section. Draw near, O nations, to hear, and listen, O peoples. Let the earth and all it contains hear, and the world and all that springs from it. For the Lord's indignation is against all the nations, and his wrath against all their armies. He has utterly destroyed them. He has given them over to slaughter. So their slain will be thrown out, and their corpses will give off their stench. And the mountains will be drenched with their blood. And all the hosts of heaven will wear away, and the sky will be rolled up like a scroll. All their hosts will also wither away, as a leaf withers from the vine, or as one withers from the fig tree. So he's talking to the nations and the peoples, and once again, I think that this is a reference to all of those peoples in the world who are rebellious against the purposes of God. He says, come near, you rebels. And then he calls the earth and all it contains and the world and all that springs from it as witnesses. And he's done this before. He did this at the beginning of Isaiah. It happens in Deuteronomy as well, where the heavens and the earth are called to witness what God is going to say. And what God does say with those witnesses and to those rebels is that his indignation is against those rebels, His wrath is against their armies, and it's in my translation, this is in past tense, but it's, I think, actually something that's yet to happen in the future, that they will be utterly destroyed and they will be given over to slaughter, such that there are going to be bodies all over the place. Their corpses are going to stink, and the mountains are going to be drenched in blood. So we're talking about a lot of death, a lot of blood spilling, and a very dramatic event. Also, the host of heaven will dissolve, will disappear, and the sky will roll up like a scroll. That's an image that was in Revelation. Let me see. Revelation 6. Let's look at it very briefly. I don't understand this image exactly, and I don't know what it's describing, but it is interesting that the same image occurs in both Isaiah and in Revelation. It's chapter 6 of Revelation, starting with verse 14. And the sky was split apart like a scroll when it is rolled up, and every mountain and islands were removed out of their places. So like Karin observed last week, there is a lot of imagery that is similar between Isaiah and Revelation. And what this is an image of is not, I can't visualize it very well, a scroll that's rolled up. I don't know if it means it's just kind of, it disappears. When it's all stretched out, you see the heavens, but they're all rolled up and it just kind of disappears. I'm not sure exactly what the image is. But they're all going to be gone. The host of heaven will be gone. The sky will be gone. The hosts will wither up. All of that will disappear. So there'll be this big slaughter of God's enemies, and the heavens are going to roll up. Next section. For my sword is satiated in heaven. Behold, it shall descend for judgment upon Edom and upon the people whom I have devoted to destruction. The sword of the Lord is filled with blood. It is sated with fat, with the blood of lambs and goats, with the fat of the kidneys of rams. For the Lord has a sacrifice in Bozrah and a great slaughter in the land of Edom. Wild oxen shall also fall with them, and the young bulls with strong ones. Thus their land shall be soaked with blood, and their dust become greasy with fat. So God's sword is satiated in heaven, and I'm not sure what that means. It sounds like the sword, is yet to be used, but, so I'm not sure how satiated works here. But the description we have is the sword is, later on he says, the sword of the Lord is filled with blood. So this is a judgment that takes place, and as a result of it having taken place, God's sword is filled with blood. So there's a lot of bloodshed that takes place. And this sword is going to descend for judgment upon Edom. Why Edom? And I think there's really no good answer for that. Edom has not been a participant in this. But Edom was a historic enemy of Judah in particular. Later on, when the Babylonians come, the people of Edom actually join with the Babylonians in fighting against Judah. And so some people see this as an indication that this part of Isaiah was written much later. But I think what's happening here is Edom is once again just standing in for those who are rebels against God. He did the same thing with Moab earlier, and I think he's doing this with Edom now. It's just a stand-in. It's just an example of those who are rebellious against God and his purposes. So God is going to descend in judgment upon Edom, and this judgment is going to be, it's on a people whom I have devoted to destruction. That's the same term that's used with respect to the Canaanites when the Israelites came into the land, into the promised land. They were devoted to destruction. So these are a people that God has decided, has judged to be worthy of destruction. And then in the description, it's a description of blood, of the fat of these animals, goats, the kidneys of rams. It's all terms that you would see in a sacrificial ceremony. And he says in verse 6, the Lord has a sacrifice in Bozra and a great slaughter in the land of Edom. So it's as if Edom is serving as a sacrifice. What's happening here is Edom is being sacrificed. And it goes on, the wild oxen shall also fall, young bulls will fall, and the land will be soaked with blood, and their dust become greasy with fat. So you can kind of, this I can't envision. There's blood all over, and there are guts all over, and it's even slippery and slimy as a result of all of this. It sounds like a sacrifice. The terms here are used are of a sacrifice. And I puzzled over this for a while, but Oswalt, who has written a commentary on Isaiah that I consult, he makes an interesting observation. He says, whenever there's sin, there must be a sacrifice. That whenever there's sin, there has to be a penalty paid. And it's either paid by God ultimately, or it's paid by the sinner. And in this case, Edom has been determined to be worthy of destruction, and they are going to pay the penalty for that. They will be sacrificed. Next section. For the Lord has a day of vengeance, a year of recompense for the cause of Zion, and its streams shall be turned into pitch, and its loose earth into brimstone, and its land shall become burning pitch. It shall not be quenched night or day. Its smoke shall go up forever. From generation to generation it shall be desolate. None shall pass through it forever and ever. So the Lord is, the God, the day is coming when God is going to inflict this judgment, carry out his vengeance. And it's for the cause of Zion. I think the cause of his holy place. And when he comes, Edom's streams are going to be turned into pitch, its loose earth will become brimstone, and the land will become one inferno. And that inferno will not die down. It's going to burn day and night. Its smoke shall go up forever from one generation to generation. That area will be desolate because it'll just be fire, and none shall pass through it forever and ever. So he's talking about a judgment, and again, this is in ultimate terms. It's forever and the whole land, et cetera, et cetera. So I think this is talking about the final judgment. So Edom is just standing in for those who are opposed to God's purposes. Next section. But pelican and hedgehog shall possess it, and owl and raven shall dwell in it, and he shall stretch over it the line of desolation and the plumb line of emptiness. Its nobles, there is no one there whom they may proclaim king, and all its princes shall be nothing. And thorns shall come up in its fortified towers, nettles and thistles in its fortified cities. It shall also be a haunt of jackals and an abode of ostriches. And the desert creatures shall meet with the wolves. The hairy goat also shall cry to its kind. Yes, the night monster shall settle there and shall find herself a resting place. The tree snake shall make its nest and lay eggs there, and it will hatch and gather them under its protection. Yes, the hawks shall be gathered there, every one with its kind. So now this place is a place of desolation. The only thing that will, the only things that will be there are animals. The animals will take over. Some of these animals, animals that don't like to be in the presence of humans. So we've got the pelican and the hedgehog, the owl and the raven. Those are all going to move in and take over in an area where there are no people. And then he uses an interesting couplet. And he shall stretch over it the line of desolation and the plumb line of emptiness. If you will remember back in chapter 28, he talked about 28, verse 16 and 17, where God says that he's going to establish this stone, this cornerstone. I'll read it. Therefore, thus says the Lord God, behold, I am laying in Zion a stone, a tested stone, a costly cornerstone for the foundation firmly placed. He who believes in it will not be disturbed, and I will make justice the measuring line and righteousness the level. Then hail shall sweep away the refuge of lies, and the waters shall overflow the secret place. So here he used the measuring line and the level as imagery that everything is oriented according to these things. Oriented according to righteousness and justice. That's what's coming. That's what God is going to do for the righteous. But here we have a plumb line and a line being used, but they are orienting this place of desolation differently. It is aligning this with desolation and emptiness. And interestingly, these words only occur one other place in the Bible, and that's in Genesis chapter 1. Where God saw that the earth was formless and void. Those words are tohu vabohu, formless and void. In other words, in chaos, there's no order. And this place of desolation is going to be aligned with this formlessness and voidness, this chaos. There will be none of God's order there. So this place is reverting back to what it was before God even got started. Just chaos and darkness. There will be no nobles. There's no one who can be king. So there's no leadership. And everything's going to revert. All the towers are going to be overgrown with thorns and thistles. Jackals and ostriches will move in, and we're just going to have desert creatures and wolves, the hairy goat, the night monster. They don't know what animal that is. All of those will move in. That's all that will inhabit this area. The tree snake will move in, the hawks, all with their kind, the only creatures in this place of desolation. Okay, the rest of the chapter. Seek from the book of the Lord and read. Not one of these will be missing. None will lack its mate. For his mouth has commanded, and his spirit has gathered them. And he has cast the lot for them, and his hand has divided it to them by line. They shall possess it forever from generation to generation. They shall dwell in it. This is hard. I'm not sure what this is referring to. The book, what is the book of the Lord that's being talked about here? It could be other sections of Isaiah. It could be the whole of this work that he has written. Or it could be, and this is what I'm inclined to think, all of Scripture that existed at the time. And the reason I think that is because I think we've got allusions to two different events that could have been read about in that book of Scripture that they would have had at this time. The first event is the flood. And the second event is when the Israelites conquered and came into the promised land. And the reason I think that it's alluding to those two events is, first, it says, not one of these will be missing, none will lack its mate. So we're talking about a situation in which God has preserved pairs of animals. God preserved pairs of animals in the flood. God brought the animals two by two into the ark. And that was a means by which the created order could be perpetuated. There was provision for restoration and continuation of the created order that God had made. And I think that this is an allusion to that as well, that despite this desolation, there is provision for restoration and continuation. Verse 17, it says, and he cast the lot for them, and his land was divided, his hand has divided it to them by line. When the people went into the promised land, before they went in, they cast lots in order to determine which tribe would occupy which part of the promised land. And my best guess is that there again, there's a reference. This is alluding back to that. And in that event, it was a new order was established in Israel. The old order was destroyed completely, and a new order took its place, and the land was divided up among the people that were going to occupy it. So I think what this section is doing is saying, go look at the book and read it. What's going to happen is there will be a judgment and destruction. The flood was just like the flood was a judgment and destruction, and just like the conquest of the promised land by the Israelites was a judgment and destruction, there is provision built into it for continuation and restoration. Okay, next 10 verses. The wilderness and the desert will be glad, and the Arabah will rejoice and blossom like the crocus. It will blossom profusely and rejoice with rejoicing and shout of joy. The glory of Lebanon will be given to it, the majesty of Carmel and Sharon. They will see the glory of the Lord, the majesty of our God. Encourage and exhaust the exhausted and strengthen the feeble. Say to those with anxious heart, take courage, fear not. Behold, your God will come with vengeance. The recompense of God will come, but he will save you. Then the eyes of the blind will be opened, and the ears of the deaf will be unstopped. Then the lame will leap like a deer, and the tongue of the dumb will shout for joy. For waters will break forth in the wilderness and streams in the Arabah, and the scorched land will become a pool, and the thirsty ground springs of water. In the haunt of jackals, its resting place, grass becomes reeds and rushes. And a highway will be there, a roadway, and it will be called the Highway of Holiness. The unclean will not travel on it, but it will be for him who walks that way, and fools will not wander on it. No lion will be there, nor will any vicious beast go up on it. These will not be found there, but the redeemed will walk there, and the ransomed of the Lord will return and come with joyful shouting to Zion. With everlasting joy upon their heads, they will find gladness and joy, and sorrow and sighing will flee away. I think what it's describing here is a restoration of the land of Israel. That right now what they're seeing as the Assyrians are advancing is destruction. And the land is being just made into a wasteland. But there will be a glorious restoration that is coming. So the desert will be glad. The Arabah will blossom. Those are desert areas. And yet they will they will perk up. They will give life. Not only will they give life, but also Lebanon, Carmel, and Sharon. Remember just the previous chapter, it was talking about those areas being devastated by the Assyrians. Well, they are going to be rejoicing, and they will see the glory of God. So there's a wonderful restoration that will take place. Encourage the exhausted and strengthen the feeble. In all likelihood, in Jerusalem, seeing the Assyrians coming, there are many who would be faint of heart, exhausted and feeble. But to those, what they're supposed to say is, take courage, fear not. Behold, your God will come with vengeance. The recompense of God will come, but he will save you. So God is coming in judgment, but you will be saved. And he's going to open the eyes of the blind. He's going to unstop the ears of the deaf. The lame will leap, and the dumb will talk, will shout for joy. So the incapable will be made capable. And these are images that we've seen before, and they've been used with respect to Israel on several occasions. Furthermore, waters are going to break forth in the wilderness, and there'll be streams in the Arabah. So where there hasn't even been water, there will be abundance of water. The scorched land will become a pool, thirsty ground, springs of water. So now an abundance of water will show itself. And the haunt of jackals, its resting place, grass becomes reeds and rushes. This translation is difficult. I think the idea is that grass, reeds, and rushes will grow in all of these dry areas. Furthermore, there will be a highway, and highway shows up frequently in Isaiah. We've seen it a number of times. This highway is going to be called the Highway of Holiness. And only the righteous, only the redeemed can travel on it. The unclean and the fools cannot travel on this highway. And this highway will not have any vicious beasts, no lions, and the redeemed will therefore be able to walk on this highway in safety and without obstacle. And the ransomed of the Lord will return and come with joyful shouting to Zion, with everlasting joy upon their heads. They will find gladness and joy, and sorrow and sighing will flee away. So a complete restoration in which there will be nothing but joyfulness and gladness. The sorrow and the sighing will be gone. So these are the words that Isaiah is speaking to the people of Jerusalem at a time when the Assyrians are probably visible out in the distance, and they're coming. And they are going to lay siege to Jerusalem, and if one were playing the odds, they would destroy Jerusalem and kill many of the people that live in it and take captive many of the others. So that's what they could anticipate happening. And yet, what Isaiah is saying is, there is a glorious future that awaits you, that awaits Jerusalem, and that awaits you. It's interesting, he doesn't give any specific promises with respect to what God will do with respect to the Assyrians. And I think we can tell from now, from our vantage point here in our time, that Isaiah was really talking about things that were far in the future from the time when he was speaking. And yet, the thing that there is something here that is very important that they could take encouragement from, and that is that God will redeem them. He will save you. They don't say how, but there is salvation in God. Okay, so now, in chapter 36, 37, 38, and 39, he will switch into historical narrative, and he's going to tell us what actually happened. And we'll see what God did with respect to the Assyrian threat. And it is It is a remarkable thing that he did. Okay, questions or comments?
Yeah, David, from the perspective of the Jewish people that are hearing Isaiah say all this stuff, it seems almost like the promises that he's making, did they realistically think how far out in the future were those things? Almost like over a time frame that it's a long ways away. It's almost like for us looking at the end times or everlasting life or what's going to happen at the end. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I don't know if they see the Assyrians coming and they anticipate what's going to happen and then Isaiah's promising, yeah, but eventually, mm-hmm. but is it going to, you know, if it's so far mm-hmm. out there,
right.
it's a little different perspective than if it's going to happen within your lifetime.
Right. I think what's happening here is fascinating because if we were living at the time of Isaiah and we heard what Isaiah is saying here, at least my expectation would be that in a couple of days, Edom is going to get scorched. That's what I would expect. And that does not happen. What we're going to see does happen is Assyria is miraculously sent back home. So the Assyrian army, it besieges Jerusalem, and then they just, one night, they get up and leave, the ones that are left. And we'll read about that next week. Well, that's a phenomenal event. And the people of Jerusalem would have to look at that and say, that's got to be God. A phenomenal thing. But it wasn't Edom getting torched. So I think what they would have to do and what they were expected to do is look at that and say, God came to our rescue. There's no question about it. God came to our rescue. But there's another rescue yet to come. And I think that's what they were supposed to say to themselves. There's another greater rescue yet to come. That what happened to Assyria was just kind of the down payment. That was just kind of an indication that God would make good on his promises, but his promises ultimately are much greater and yet to be fulfilled. Anything else? Okay. Thanks.